welcome to Future Focused, Sophisticated Estate Planning with Wiggin and Dana, the show where CPAs, insurance professionals, investment brokers, trust companies, CFPs, and more can firm up on their understanding of estate planning strategies so they can better guide their clients to make wise decisions with their legacy. Future Focus is hosted by Aaron Nichols and Michael Clear, partners of the Private Client Services Department at Wiggin and Dana. Subscribe to Future Focused, Sophisticated Estate Planning on your favorite podcast platform and share episodes with your clients. And now, here are your hosts, Aaron and Michael.
Welcome to Future Focused. I'm your host, Michael Clear, and joined today, welcome back, Aaron Nichols.
I'm very excited to be back.
We've had a couple great episodes with some guests. And today we wanted to get back into some planning related topics. We're going to talk about some practical insights on the Corporate Transparency Act. As you may recall, we did an episode towards the end of 2023 on the genesis of the Corporate Transparency Act. And as we're in April at this point, now that the episode is launched, and it's actually time for some entities to start reporting. Aaron, why don't you give us a little more information on that?
Yeah, absolutely. Now is the time that this is really going into action. Yeah, so as everyone probably knows, we're now starting the time period in which entities will actually be required to submit reports under the Corporate Transparency Act. So we want to go through the steps that we think people should take if they have an entity that was formed by the filing of a document with a government organization, for example, like a Secretary of State. So if you have that type of entity, you should go through a few steps to determine whether you have a filing requirement, and if so, what information is needed. So I think some helpful things to address in this episode will be the exemptions under the Corporate Transparency Act and whether they would apply to the entity. If no exemption applies, then you need to go through an analysis of who the beneficial owners and company applicants are. And then finally, once you have that information, you need to collect additional data on owners and applicants in order to submit on your beneficial ownership report.
So today what we'll do is we'll go over some highlights of the exemptions that are available. We'll talk about beneficial ownerships, we'll talk about company applicants, and we'll talk about the information required for the beneficial ownership information report. I think just from a highlight, and maybe we already said it, but it's worth repeating. So we've created an entity on January 15th by filing an LLC with the Connecticut Secretary of State. What date am I worried about?
So you're going to make me do math in my head. It is 90 days. So I think that would bring you to April 14th.
So now I should be worried about this now.
Exactly. Don't rely on the math in my head. Make sure that you know when 90 days from the date of formation of the entity is. So as a reminder, the Corporate Transparency Act came into effect as of January 1st this year. But reporting for entities that had been created prior to 2024 is being delayed until 2025. So the only types of entities that are concerned about filing right now are ones that were created in early 2024.
And ongoing.
Exactly. So the 90 days. So now, given that we're in April, you absolutely should be thinking about this if you formed on January 15th.
Okay, so let's jump in. Does an exemption apply?
Yeah, and unfortunately, it sounds exciting at the outset because there are 23 exemptions, and that might give people the idea that it would be pretty easy to fall under one of them. Unfortunately, not the case. And we think that for the vast majority of our clients, it's unlikely that any exemption will apply because largely the purpose of these exemptions relates to entities that are already highly regulated. So for example, pooled investment vehicles, various types of banking entities, nonprofits that already have strong application and reporting requirements. So really, they're just exempting people who already are providing this disclosure that the CTA is looking for. So most likely, your entity will not fall under an exemption, but certainly it's worth checking. And if you have any questions, to certainly consult with an attorney about it.
As we look now into what we're reporting, as we already hinted at, we're aiming towards the beneficial ownership information report. Who are the beneficial owners of a company?
Yeah, it sounds so easy.
I have the best part of this podcast, Aaron.
The questions are easy. The answers get more complex because, in a short summary, a beneficial owner is any individual who directly or indirectly exercises substantial control over a reporting company that we've just described, or owns or controls 25% or more of the ownership interests in the reporting company. So even that might sound simple on its face, but it gets very complicated very quickly. And it would probably be worth mentioning a couple of examples to see how the complexity would play out in situations. But if you're someone who owns an LLC, you own 100% of an LLC that's a real estate holding company, you're likely to have an extremely straightforward experience with this. But if, for example, like in our world, often these entities are owned by trusts. Well, then you need to analyze the trust agreement and determine who is exercising substantial control under that agreement, typically the trustee, but also others, non-fiduciaries with powers of amendment, or I think potentially a trust protector, depending on the scope of responsibility, could fall under that category. And then also people who would be considered substantial owners, which in the Treasury's mind is going to be a beneficiary, if that beneficiary is the sole current beneficiary, they'll be deemed to be an owner for purposes of reporting under the CTA. So certainly being able to figure out who is under the purview of that in a trust agreement is complicated. It might be even more complicated if there is a situation with a complex organizational chart. So, for example, you have a lot of different parent-subsidiary relationships, and you might have complex ownership structures beyond that in terms of how equity is held, whether there are options and what types of debt the entity holds. So certainly there's a lot of complexity there, and we anticipate clients likely needing to consult with counsel in a circumstance like that. One thing that is certainly worth pointing out now is just that you can't assume that exemptions apply uniformly throughout an organizational chart. So put another way, if you have a parent company that an exemption applies to, that exemption is not automatically applied to its subsidiaries. So it might be a bit counterintuitive in that way, but truly at each level of the organizational chart, you need to do the exemption analysis and, again, this beneficial ownership analysis.
So going easy, a couple easy examples. So I created an LLC in January. And we have five equal owners. Each of us own 20%, if I did my math correctly. So we have no one that owns or controls, let's just say it's individuals, no one that owns or controls more than 25%. So my beneficial owner would be the people who exercise substantial control.
Correct. Again, that will require analysis of the entity's governing documents, because generally, that means senior officers, but it could also be anyone who has authority to appoint, for example, a board member, or may not be a senior officer, but holds some important decision-making authority within an operating agreement. So there are a lot of situations in which a more specific analysis is necessary. I will say that in addition to speaking to your attorney, if you have questions about that, the Treasury has FAQs published that are illuminating on that topic.
We've identified the need to do the reporting and our timing. We realize that we do not qualify for an exemption, and we've done an analysis of who are the beneficial owners. Now we have this new category, the company applicant. What can you tell us about company applicants?
So this may be slightly more straightforward than the beneficial ownership analysis, but in addition to the beneficial owners, the Treasury Department wants to know who was responsible for creating the entity. Now, it's not just as simple as whomever is signing the document that actually creates the entity, because the Treasury wants to know not just who directly filed, but also anyone else who indirectly was involved in forming the company. So potentially we have these two categories of company applicants, and it's not necessarily clear exactly what they're looking for here. Just by the plain reading of the statute, we were comfortable in thinking that the client would be the responsible filer, as in the primary person who's directing the filing, but not actually doing the filing. And then the direct filer would be the person who's actually submitting it. In our case, where Michael and I practice, we use service company to do that. And the service company has unique identifying numbers to provide to act as a company applicant. That said, based on the FAQs, it seems as though the Treasury Department really wants to know the attorneys involved in the formation of these companies. So a little inside baseball here, we've learned from our partner, Carolyn, that initially a piece of this legislation would have ideally dealt directly with attorneys. The Treasury wanted to know the people who were responsible for the legal formation of these companies. They didn't get that into the act, so it's not in the plain language of the statute, but by the FAQs, you can see that that's what they're looking for. So we are now, as a group, discussing exactly who will be a company applicant. So we won't say definitively in your circumstance what the answer is, but it could be any one of a number of individuals. So something that seems like a straightforward question might not be, and it might require consultation with the council.
So we're filing, we don't have an exemption, we've identified our beneficial owners, we've worked hard to identify our company applicants. Now we have to file a report.
Yes, you have to file the report. The report is absolutely 100% responsibility of the entity, but the beneficial owners and company applicants need to be cooperative in providing the necessary information to the company in order for the company to complete the report. So it should be relatively easy to provide the necessary information, because they're not looking for a whole biography. They simply want the person's full legal name, date of birth, current residential address, and then a unique identifying number. And really, for most people, that will be your driver's license number or US passport number, whichever you prefer, but it has to be a non-expired form of identification. It could also be a government issued just ID card, or if none of those apply and it's a foreign individual, then a non-expired foreign passport would suffice. You do need to provide a copy of the identifying document in addition to the number that is on it. So it might be a pain to some people to have to scan that in, but that really is the biggest hurdle with respect to the information collected. Now, as an alternative, if someone is a beneficial owner of a lot of different companies, or you're an advisor or attorney who routinely does this for clients, you may want to consider an alternative, which is applying to FinCEN with the Treasury for a unique identifying number issued by FinCEN. So Michael and I are very familiar with a similar process that we do at the IRS to get P PTIN numbers that identify us as tax preparers with the IRS. Similar process, you would provide all of the information I just mentioned, but you do it one time and then you get a number from FinCEN. So slightly easier, but you do need to keep in mind that if any of that underlying information changes, for example, if you move, you are obligated to update FinCEN about your new residential address. So unlike the PTIN example, where Michael and I don't have to remember to update them if something changes, because we simply are responsible for renewing our application every year to essentially affirm the information. Mm-hmm. Here, there's no such requirement of affirming every year. So it's incumbent upon you to remember, which seems like something that could be easily forgotten. You're given 30 days from the date of a change to update. So we'll be keeping that in mind for sure.
Okay, so that's the applicant and beneficial ownership information. What about the reporting company?
It is pretty similar, but I guess it should be noted that you need to provide, in addition to the legal name of the entity, any trade names or doing business as names, even if those alternative names are not registered. For the address, instead of residential, you would provide the primary place of business. If it's a foreign entity that is simply registered to do business, so it doesn't have a primary place of business in the US, then they can simply provide the primary location in the US where they're conducting business. And then they're also, they need to provide the jurisdiction in which the entity was formed. For a foreign reporting company, again, they won't have a domestic jurisdiction to provide. So instead, they will report the jurisdiction in which they are registered to conduct business. So for example, if it is a company that was formed in United Arab Emirates, and it simply has registered with the New York Secretary of State to conduct business in the state of New York, then that foreign company is disclosing that registration with the state of New York. And then, of course, instead of a passport or license number, the entity would need to provide its taxpayer identification number.
I think that's a very practical overview of things that clients and other business owners, business creators need to take into consideration now that the Corporate Transparency Act and the Beneficial Ownership Information Report are required filings for people. I think we should probably note that, you know, in there is a court case out there that has ruled it to be unconstitutional. Should clients rely upon that?
No, and gosh, that is a great question. I appreciate you bringing it up, but no, there was a federal district court case in Alabama where the district court judge concluded that the information sought to be collected under this act, it was unconstitutional. The Treasury Department has announced that its interpretation of that ruling is that it only applies to the plaintiffs in that case. So there were a group of plaintiffs and a named individual and his companies that will be exempt from filing until this is further adjudicated. It's assumed that the government will appeal if they haven't done so already. So it'll go to the Circuit Court of Appeals to be heard again.
So don't rely upon that headline.
Don't rely upon that headline at all. And I will echo something that Carolyn told us in the prior CTA episode, which is just that the US is very behind the rest of the world in requiring these sorts of registries for information. The basis of this statute is related to anti-money laundering. So even though the information it's collecting might be a pain, this puts us closer to on par with what other nations are doing in an attempt to stop money laundering. So certainly one benefit of the CTA registry as contemplated is that it is private. The information that you are submitting, as a reminder, is not available to the public. it can only be disclosed in the normal course pursuant to search warrant or similar order. It is not subject to FOIA, Freedom of Information Act request. So the public would not be able to get the information. And that is contrasted with a lot of other nations that make these registries public information. So if that's any consolation that you can't rely on the order, then remind yourself of that. But certainly there's more to come on this. Things will develop. And I would also advise everyone to be on the lookout for states now enacting similar statutes. New York has already done so. I think California has done so or is in the process of doing so, and other states are likely to follow suit. So I think that the concept of the CTA is here to stay.
Thanks, Erin, for the wonderful summary. I think what we've learned here is that A, it's time for many entities to start reporting. B, it may be fairly simple and straightforward for that entity, but it's also very possible that hard questions come up quickly on identifying the beneficial owner's substantial control and the company applicants. And when those questions come up, they're most likely going to need to seek legal counsel to find those answers. So thanks for joining me and giving us that update.
Thanks for having me. Again, it was great to be back, and it's an exciting topic to talk about. So it was a fun episode.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to Future Focused, Sophisticated Estate Planning, hosted by Erin Nichols and Michael Clear, partners of the Private Client Services Department at Wiggin and Dana. At Wiggin and Dana, our aim is preserving the wealth that a family has worked so hard to create, and pride ourselves in offering value-driven solutions and results. Subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast platform, share episodes with your clients, and follow our highly talented, creative, and experienced lawyers on LinkedIn for even more great insight. We'll see you next time on Future Focused, Sophisticated Estate Planning.